Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Sandro Galea, who is the Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health, which just so happens to be my public health alma mater. Welcome, Sandro, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I will begin with what might be an old chestnut. What is public health?
You know, public health is what we do together to create the conditions for health. And those words are intentional. There is no such thing as an individual public health. Public health is something that has to require engagement by people at multiple levels of society. It is about creating clean air, drinkable water, nutritious food, opportunity for exercise, about making sure everybody has a sustainable, livable wage. People are not subject to risk of violence or risk of occupational injury, that when one is driving their car on the road, they don't have undue risk of dying. It is also about making sure that everybody can live a full life from birth through to old, healthy old age. And public health essentially is keeping us healthy. It is the complement to medicine, which is where we go to a doctor to restore us to health if we are already sick. But the goal of public health is one level, I suppose, to make sure that you never have to go to the doctor to begin with.
Do you see that as overlapping with, or maybe they're related concepts, public health and population health?
I think the population health has been used in very different ways, so I want to be clear about that. In medicine, the term population health management has been used to talk about health management organizations and helping large organizations help people have better health behavior. So that's how that's been used in that context. But broadly speaking, I think population health science is the science of understanding how one generates health in populations. And that science then is what goes on to inform public health, which is the practice of what we learn from that science to the end of improving health.
Would you say that your concept, your conception of public health, or a generally accepted concept of public health, has evolved over the course of your career?
I think it has sharpened. I think the distinction, which you just prefaced, between population health science, which is the basic science of understanding how health is generated, and public health, which is the implementation of that science, the practice of creating a world that generates health, I think that distinction has sharpened in my mind. I think the other thing that has evolved in my career, I now have about a 25-year career in public health, is a greater realization that to create the conditions that generate health, of which I am speaking, it is not sufficient to focus only on perhaps more traditional functions of public health, infectious disease surveillance, and making sure that restaurants are clean, and that people get screened for diabetes, that we need to create a world that generates health, where public health has moved more into the business of ensuring that you have the opportunity to step outside of your house and go for a walk to get exercise, that it is you are not in danger of unnecessary injury, that you are not subject to the traumas of discrimination. All of that is well within the remit of public health. And I think now that's become much clearer.
So within that sharpening, if you will, of the definition of public health, what does it mean to be a practitioner? And more specifically, how do you see your role evolving in your current position or from previous positions to your current position?
So I've been a population health scientist, which in my own scholarship, I'm an epidemiologist, and I've done a lot of work thinking about how social forces generate health and how trauma in particular has an impact on mental health. That's in my own science. I have, in my role as a dean of the School of Public Health, my job is to create an opportunity for students to learn all the aspects of public health through learning from world-class scientists, from educators who are teaching them how to think in public health and give them exposure to practice, to the practice of public health. In my own practice, to use that term, I have both done science and tried to create the conditions for excellence in scholarship, teaching, and practice that our students can become accustomed to and learn from as they move on to their career.
Great. And you have recently put out a new book. You have a number of books out. Recent book is something that has drawn from a blog that you've been writing, as I understand it, over the last couple of years or so.
Yeah, that's right. So I've been writing this blog for the past couple of years called The Healthiest Goldfish. I'll explain the title.
I'm sure there's a story behind that.
There is, yeah. So title refers to a bit of a metaphor, which is you have a goldfish and you want your goldfish to be healthy. And you can encourage your goldfish to exercise by swimming around this bowl. And if the goldfish gets sick, you can get it a great goldfish doctor. But unless the goldfish has clean water to swim in, it's never going to be healthy. So the metaphor is to create the healthiest goldfish, you need to have the healthiest water. So that has been a story which I've used for decades in terms of explaining what public health does. And in the blog, The Healthiest Goldfish, I have been reflecting on a range of topics, many of them catalyzed by the COVID pandemic. So the book that just came out called Within Reason is a sort of compilation, but taking up to the next level of 50 essays around topics that emerged from the COVID pandemic, about how we can and should think about trade-offs, how we should communicate better, how we should make sure that public health is not overly politicized, about how we in public health should operate with humility. These are ideas that emerge for me in observing how public health operated in 2020, 2021, and 2022.
Is it your sense that things that you saw during the course of the pandemic were issues that were already there but just thrown into high relief as a result of the pandemic and the dislocation of that, or were there new issues?
I think there were things that were already there. And like much else, the pandemic didn't create anything. It unveiled, it elevated, it sharpened our view of things. And I think that was true, equally true for social problems, social fractures, as it was true of challenges that public health faced. So I do think it was about elements of public health that needed a careful examination and that we had not done that examination until this moment.
In some of your comments about the book, you talk about public health is a liberal pursuit, now perhaps stuck in an illiberal time. I've got that right?
And you do have that right.
Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and so I should clarify about what I mean by liberal, because I don't mean the word liberal in the sense of leftist or Democrat. I mean the word liberal in the classic sense of the word liberal, which is a way of thinking about the world which elevates individual autonomy over and above everything else, that prizes data that informs reason and logic, that says that we reform the world not through belief in, but through observing the natural world around us. A lot of these ideas emerged from the Renaissance in the Western world, although they are beliefs that have been essentially promulgated in a lot of strains of thought, including Eastern thought, for many centuries. So I mean by liberal, being open to ideas, being informed by data, not being overly rigid in one's perspective, and putting front and center the importance of individuals and individuals having autonomy to live their lives as they wish. And my contention is that this is an illiberal time, that it's a time where we have seen a closing of minds. We have seen a narrowing of perspectives. We have seen a willing an unwillingness, a reluctance to consider that there might be different values, different beliefs, different approaches to complex problems. And that, of course, came to a head during COVID. And it is our job to not do that and to think differently.
Do you think it is possible, even within the realm of health, for public health practitioners to move the needle in that sort of ocean, if you will, of cultural ferment?
You know, I want to think it's possible, David. I do think it's possible because I prefer hope. And I wrote the book out of a belief that if we have enough conversations, we can move past the cultural foment, out of a belief that the collective closing of minds, the collective culture that we're in right now, that I think you were implicitly hinting at, of, let's say, censoriousness and vituperative disputation, does not always have to be that way, and that we can achieve a place where we thrive in discussion and debate.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Sandra Galea, Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. Sandra, you mentioned earlier that the book that just came out is composed of essays that were originally appearing in another form on your blog, The Healthiest Goldfish. I blogged for many years myself. I enjoyed it. It's a very different kind of writing than other kinds of writing. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, coming at this from the perspective of an academic, perspective of an epidemiologist. How did you approach blogging? What was your goal
to
write a blog?
You know, I slid into it, perhaps without as much deliberation as one might think. You know, when I first became dean of the school in 2015, I started writing a note to our school community, which I call the Dean's Note. And it was about 1,000 words on topics that I thought were important to service in public health. And I was doing it as much to sharpen my thinking about public health as much as it was to help our internal school community, but then also the external public health community, develop a shared understanding of what public health was about, which is going back to the first question that you asked me. And those Dean's Notes, I pushed forward for several years until they actually became a book, which was called Healthier, 50 Thoughts on the Foundations of Population Health. And then as sort of time passed where I felt like those pieces were no longer necessary, it evolved, COVID happened, and I did some other writing, and I thought I probably should start writing again in the form of weekly, I guess blogs is the term. And these blogs are also about 1,000 words each, and they take a topic a week, and I had an intention of compiling them into, folding them up into a book in time, which is exactly what I did, and roughly the same thing as what I have in mind with what I write right now.
So you describe something that I found to be the case myself in my own blogging, which is that writing a post helps sharpen one's own thinking about a topic. And I'm wondering if you found at any time that a few months later you came to disagree with yourself, with something that you had posted earlier.
Well, let me comment on that in two pieces. Number one is there's no question in my mind that when you write something, it sharpens your thinking. You know, we get away with a lot of stuff when we just speak. We speak and we intersperse speech with conjunctions and with verbal tics and with digressive thoughts, and that's acceptable in speech. It's much harder to get away with that when you write. So when you write, if you want your writing to be sharp and clear, it forces your thoughts to become sharp and clear. So there's no question that I find writing sharpens my thinking. Now you ask, have I changed my mind about things? I suppose the answer is yes. Obviously, everybody changes their mind, but I would see it more as an evolution in my thinking. For example, I wrote several, maybe 5-6 years ago, about the role of paternalism in public health. And recognizing that public health has aspirations that are inherently paternalistic. And I wrote more favorably of paternalism than I did more recently when I wrote about paternalism. And the reason my thoughts evolved on that is because I felt that during COVID, public health overplayed its paternalistic hand, that we prescribed for populations particular behaviors that populations did not want for far too long. And that was simply a mistake. So I think my thoughts on paternalism evolved, and I wrote about it again, referencing my earlier writing. And I suppose what I highlighted in my thoughts is that I wrote my first piece on paternalism with a certain set of assumptions about public health's self-regulation, which then I realized do not necessarily hold. Hence, my thoughts had to be revised.
Understood. So I'll read that as saying that maybe you didn't change your mind, but the world changed around you.
Well, I don't think it's unreasonable to say I changed my mind, but I suppose I changed my mind in the sense that when the data change, one should change one's mind, and the data were my inputs from the world. So I'm okay taking the absorbing the charge that I changed my mind, but hopefully I changed my mind because it was right to change my mind.
So we've been talking a bit about the interaction with the years of COVID, and I'm wondering if you would comment further, particularly as an epidemiologist, how has COVID changed us?
COVID was, we should go back to basics, and COVID was the most important health crisis that we have faced as a world in 100 years. It recently was. There's no question about that. And it resulted in a drop in life expectancy in this country, setting us back 10 years. Now, nothing else has ever done that. So COVID was huge, and it was tragic for millions, literally millions of people. And as a result, it should change us. And I think in some respects, this sorrow is if it doesn't change us, is if we don't stop and think about what we should be learning, what we should have learned in a time of COVID. Because the tragedy is exacerbated if we do not look back, if we don't take a moment to learn from COVID. Now, let's talk about what should we be learning. Well, I think we should be learning about how we think about how we generate health. I think we should be learning about how we go about our business of generating health. And I think on both of those, there are things that we can and should learn. I think on how we think about health, this is where my subtitle, liberal public health, comes in. We should be thinking about a public health that listens to multiple perspectives, that recognizes that people bring different values, that recognizes that first and foremost, people don't live to be healthy, but they're healthy so they can live, and that restrictions on people's autonomy are only worthwhile insofar as they help people live. For example, just to be concrete, something which I talk about in the book is, we imposed restrictions on people being with their loved ones as they were dying out of notion that the people don't want to get COVID themselves. But as human beings, we care more about being with our loved ones, giving them a last hug and a last kiss, and we're willing to take the risk for that. And we in public health did not see that. We did not see the importance of dignity of dying. And these are conceptual lessons that we should have learned. We did not recognize that trade-offs, people are comfortable with trade-offs. And then I think at the level of implementation, we did not communicate well. We communicated with false certitude. We said things in a way that made it seem like we were certain. And then when the data changed, we changed our mind, and then people stopped trusting us. And we tried to implement efforts that really had no chance of happening because we thought we should insist on them. And of course, people ignored them and we lost people's confidence. And I suppose one could listen to what I'm saying and roll one's eyes and say, you're just saying that, but no harm was done. But when you look at opinion polling, public health is about 25% less trusted than it was before COVID. And that's a real problem. And that is in the aftermath of this really important health event. And one where public health saved millions of lives, both through early vaccines.
I said a lot of rare, I was going to say.
Yeah, one objectively, public health did a lot of good. So if we did so much good and people trust us less, I think we should be asking, wait a second, well, what did we do wrong? Because objectively, public health did a lot of good. So the fact that there is less trust now means that there are ways in which we went about doing that good that lost us trust, and we should be examining what that is so that we can regain that trust.
You said a few words about generating health. That's a very interesting turn of phrase to me. And I'm wondering if you could explicate that a little further.
Yeah, I think health emerges from choices we make as a society. Let's be concrete about it. We choose, let me use cars as an example. Let me start with the easy part. We choose to require seatbelts. And that choice translates into fewer people dying when there are motor vehicle collisions, right? So that choice generates health. It generates health when there are collisions. Now, that is a choice that is at the moment not contested. Now, let me talk about another choice. We choose to set the speed limit at 55 miles per hour on certain highways. But we know that at 55 miles per hour, you're twice more likely to die in a collision than if you were driving at 35 miles per hour. Really, it would be much safer if we only all drove at 25 miles per hour. So we are there making a choice that where we are privileging other inputs rather than just our health and recognizing that our health might suffer because we care about other things, namely mobility and getting from A to B faster. So all of these are choices that we make that generate health. And we do not think about it that way, but I think it is entirely true. We choose, for example, to regulate certain industries in the products that they can, that they generate. That is positive and negatives. So these are choices that we make. And those choices are generating health. And once we become aware of that, we can then make those choices in an informed way and recognize that those choices arise from inputs, that health is something that we care about, but we also care about other things. We also care about social function. We care about economic function. Let's talk, for example, about the choices we made to keep schools closed during COVID. Those choices were choices that privileged over and above reducing the transmission of COVID as much as possible, even though we knew that children were less likely to get COVID, less likely to transmit COVID. As a result of those choices, we have restricted children's educational and social development. The children are now about 6 months behind in their educational and social development. And that is, these are choices that we made.
All very interesting. And the recent experience with COVID is a fascinating frame for looking at broader issues in the realm of public health. I want to finish up our conversation with one final question, which is, if you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what might be one thing in healthcare that you would hope or maybe expect to find has changed drastically?
Let me offer two things. I know you asked me about one. Number one is, I hope that we have learned our lesson in COVID about the importance of health gaps and health disparities, and that certain people have access to much less opportunity for health than others, and that that becomes something that we care about and focus on. That's number one. Number two, I think that the healthcare itself stands to have so much improvement in this country that as technologies become more widespread that help streamline availability of healthcare, I'm hoping that we'll get to a point where we shall have a healthcare that's more responsive to people's needs. And there's so much space to go between here and there that if we can make movements on that in the next 5 years, that would be wonderful.
Okay. Well, something to look forward to.
One would hope so.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thank you, David. Thank you for hosting me. Thank you for what you do to encourage these kind of conversations.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.